Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Duluth Superior are home to many talented writers. Tonight, we feature original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 6th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organize a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 22 writers were chosen by 3 judges to read their stories and poems on the theme of transformation. The public reading was held on Saturday, January 30th, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince.
My name is Jan Cronister, and from Maple, I'm going to read 2 poems. Trajectory. Tell me about love. How the days pile up on the dark side of the moon, and all of a sudden we know life is stuck, a drawer we cannot close, backing into its cavern, away from the light of a room, from a place where something happened to both of us, an unequal blooming in 2 directions, distance of an inch, perhaps, between 2 paths. And now we eat and sleep in different places, yet still a familiarity with the other half, so that we each finish other's thoughts, meet in the same places every year. Diminishment. Lichen-coated apple branches like near-death arms grasp at me as I prune and gather, stick to my sweater. One jabs my hand, I bleed. In the bonfire, they spit and snap, angry to be burned. With a little more time, they could have sent up new shoots to the sun. My dad is a stranger now. Hands that crafted furniture struggle with a spoon. He has no idea the 3 of us boxed up his things for Goodwill. We divide a container of rice from their wedding 65 years ago. My sister hands me a baggie full of mom's watches, one from high school graduation, another they bought together at Wall Drug, inset with coral and turquoise. I wear it, remember when they were still our parents, bearing fruit.
Hi, I'm Carol Dunbar, and 12 years ago, my husband and I moved off the grid. We are independent with regard to heat, water, and electricity. We've raised 2 kids with no clothes dryer, no microwave, endured winters without hot water, and summers without AC. I struggle less with what we live without and more with who we live with. The bears, skunks, snakes, spiders, rodents, bugs. The working title of my memoir is Truce. And this essay is from the section I imagine will be dedicated to my 3 greatest teachers, all of whom happen to be dogs. We adopted Helgi, a giant Alaskan Malamute, just 3 days after Thanksgiving. And by our first spring together, I recognized in him a shared personality trait, what I like to think of as tenacity, and what others might call stubbornness. Weighing in at 124 pounds, Helgi, Icelandic for celebration, is an outdoor dog the size of a small pony with fur frosting white. As a hunter, you can always tell from the quality of his barking what it is he has cornered. And at 4 a.m. that spring morning, I awoke to the high-pitched yelps that meant Helgi could only be out there celebrating one thing: porcupine. I flew out of bed, banded a headlamp around my forehead, and shoved my feet into the first shoes I could find, my daughter's garden Crocs, Wearing nothing but a thin black nightgown, I charged out into the woods. No, Helgi, leave the porcupine alone! I yelled into the night, no moon, no stars. I followed the barking, left the path, and barreled up a hill that sloped along the east side of our house. The incline spanned a good acre, crammed with deadfall and spindly branches that poked and stabbed through the flimsy crocks as I wobbled along, screeching, "You will not eat this porcupine, Helgi! You will not!" We had other dogs get quilled before, but Helgi was the first dog that actually tried to eat the porcupine. 3 weeks prior, when the porcupines came out of hibernation, Helgi came onto the porch, paws bloodied and head slung low. His face wore a thick beard of quills, the ivory points long and tipped elegantly in black. Helgi couldn't close his mouth or lie down or drink water. He swung his head between bruised paws and stumbled blind with pain. $500, 48 hours, and one overnight stay at the emergency vet hospital later, he was back to his sweet-natured self, a gentle giant with the tongue of a butterfly. The first time, the vet told us that Helgi had quills inside his gums, through his tongue, and all down the sides of his throat. The second time, they speared through his nose like exotic African bone jewelry. The third time, the quills were confined to a crowded patch around his snout. The fourth time, I was so disgusted I could hardly look. In the beams of my roving headlamp, I caught him leaping and pouncing around a downed balsam fir, tail raised like a flag. He barked and yipped and jabbed with his snout. I shone my light along the tree, big as a canoe, and there was the porcupine, scurrying in circles with the halo of his quills pulsing like a shivering star. We had spent nearly $1,000 on porcupine quill removal. I was not going to watch the last of our savings slip away. I broke off a spiny branch from the deadfall and wielded it like a jousting stick to prod my dog. Helgi snapped and growled. The porcupine dodged sideways. Helgi darted after him. I threw myself between them, standing in two small shoes on a steep grade littered with woodland debris, wearing a stupid nightgown. I knocked into logs and branches, screaming like a crazy person. We fought and hollered in the dark for what seemed like 20 minutes before we ended up close enough to the house to wake my husband and two kids. They arrived, corralled the dog, and the porcupine escaped. Porcupines can't really run. They sort of wobble back and forth. Their quills, deadly in the face of a dog, are really nothing more than toothpick-sized straws that move together like waves of wheat. This one was larger than a school globe, but with a small face, and he held his hands in front of him fretfully as he hustled away. The porcupine ended up on our porch, standing in the corner like a chastened pupil, his back to the world. He stayed that way for nearly a full hour. That was when I finally accepted that as long as Helgi was our dog, and that porcupine was in our woods, Helgi would continue to get quilled. We found a box the size of a kitchen cupboard and nudged the porcupine inside. He went rather willingly. My husband took the kids and drove 6 miles up the road where they opened the box and let him waddle free. After driving the porcupine, we loaded Helgi into the back of the minivan. I have found a country vet willing to inject my dog with tranquilizers for a reasonable fee while I remove the quills. I had never done such a thing before, but the vet and his assistant taught me how to use the tools, how to fold back the lips and check along his gums, how to squeeze and recognize signs of broken quills and wiggle them free. Helgi's head is bigger than my head, and it was like rooting around inside the mouth of a lion. But I did it. I pulled the quills, plunked down my money, and drove home our mighty warrior passed out in the back of the minivan. My dog has the intelligence of a toddler, and yet we share a mindset. I also believe that if I just try harder, don't give up, that I'll get what I want. But sometimes that way of thinking only gets you a mouthful of quills. Sometimes the right thing to do is just walk away, let it be, and pay the bill. Thank you.
My name is Liz Manette. And this is my piece called Rabbit. The dead rabbit scared her. She was shoveling powdered sugar snow off the concrete porch, and there it was, laying between the house's foundation and where the lavender and thyme remained hardy beneath a blanket of snow, contained yet in their squat, sun-faded planters. One of its feet propped like soft luck on the basement sill, the rabbit looked like it had been trying for something. No blood or snatches of hair, no gray ghost of wings sailing above snow. It looked like a forgotten, oversized mitten. It had the coloring of neighborhood calico, nobody's cat, who subsisted intuitively, shyly, house to house, on scraps and kindness. The rabbit's plump body and gentle eyelids made it look like it was simply sleeping. The woman, gingerly, touched it with shovel's edge, afraid it would spring awake. Nothing. The rabbit cupped neatly into shovel's well, and the woman walked with its limp, dappled body over to Norway pine, tossed it, where it disappeared beneath a puff of snow. Food for other things later. The woman returned to the steps, continued shoveling, and where the rabbit had been, a dark scrape of earth against home. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Diana Granger, and my transformation story is called From Prince to Frog. The transformation did not take place by a little enchanted well, but rather on the railroad tracks by the bounteous, beautiful waters of Lake Superior. One small event, or as it happened, non-event, changed my life's trajectory and sense of self. A little freight train derailed my life, and it happened one summer in 1964. Most summers, our family traveled north to Bayfield, Wisconsin, where we could escape the oppressive heat of southern Michigan and enjoy one of the world's most beautiful vistas. Clear blue water, reddish-brown sandstone cliffs, sandy beaches, white birch trees, and the Apostle Islands, verdant and beckoning. On our July visit in 1964, in addition to our family of six, there were also my fiancé, a graduate student working on his PhD in classics. I wanted my future life's partner to feel the majesty and magnetism of the greatest of lakes and become as fond of the North Woods as I was. I was 21, planning a wedding in 6 months, and had mapped out my future very precisely. I was to be the wife of a college professor, attending faculty teas, hosting cocktail parties, socializing with the cognoscenti, and maybe eventually raising two brilliant children. Think Mrs. Chips merged with Joe from Little Women, who after she marries Professor Bear. my march through life would be on walkways besides walls covered in ivy. Each year, our family stayed at a small motel owned by some cousins of ours. The motel was on a cliff overlooking the small harbor of Bayfield in the east. About halfway down the cliff were railroad tracks, which had once transported lumber, frozen fish, apples, and other products to markets south and east. In the early 60s, trucks began replacing trains as a major means of transportation. But in 1964, some trains did still run. We children had always used the railroad tracks as a pathway to walk along the lake, and then we would slide down on our rear ends down a steep slope to a deserted sandy beach where we dared each other to run and dive into the icy waters of Lake Superior. My fiancé said he was not training for the Spartan army, and he would eschew immersions into so cold a body of water. It was a glorious morning that July, as the four of us, my little sister, my young cousin, my fiancé, and I, made our way down to the beach, which was known to us as the Coal Docks. The girls, I want to say little girls, but actually they were 9 and 10, and considered themselves very grown up, ran straight for the water, skipping out into the gentle waves, then settling back to make a sand fort. My fiancé and I sat on a log, and I told him about the native peoples, the French fur traders, and the lumbering days. He seemed captivated by the resplendence of the lake, and maybe me, I flattered myself. I think it was hunger pains which drove the four of us to leave this little piece of heaven, to scoot up the dirt bank to the railroad tracks. We walked back slowly to the motel, watching the seagulls skim the waters below us and enjoying the sensation of the warm sun embracing us and the light breeze cooling our faces. The girls were up ahead of us, running, walking, giggling, and talking, stooping to pick wildflowers along the tracks and shouting for us to hurry up. My fiancé and I walked contentedly along the tracks, holding hands and exulting in the perfectness of the moment. I gazed at my cousin's braids, like those of native girls centuries past, bouncing rhythmically along her back as she ran up ahead, and I was struck by how golden my sister's hair looked, shimmering in the bright noonday sun. As we made the last turn on our route back, we observed, disconcertingly, a freight train headed south toward us. My fiancé, perhaps conditioned by Hollywood, tugged at my elbow and cried out, "A train is coming! We've got to get off the tracks!" I looked into his green eyes, usually bright with intelligence and amusement, but now only registering terror. "We can't forget the girls!" I croaked and broke away from him, running up the tracks to where the two girls were. Dimly, I was aware that my fiancé had not followed me on my charge to rescue the children. Without a word, I pulled the two startled girls off the tracks, none too gently, I fear, crying out, "The train is coming!" "The train has stopped. It always stops the fisheries before moving on," said my young cousin, her voice registering the contempt of a hometown girl, scornful of the foolishness of an outsider. Looking at the tracks, I saw that indeed the train had stopped. Even if the train really was coming, you didn't need to yank us off the tracks like that. "We're not stupid, you know," my sister complained indignantly. I apologized to the girls and tried to explain I just reacted without thinking. I looked back at my fiancé as he emerged from the ditch by the tracks, 30 feet behind me, and then watched him slowly come up to where I stood. At that moment, it was like the tracks were suddenly electric. Every cell in my body reeled in shock. I suppose it was the shock of recognition. I could never marry any man who would save himself without making sure children were safe, even if the danger wasn't real. The neatly scripted playbook of my life was being ripped to pieces. I heard sherry decanters shattering, saw cucumber sandwiches flying off silver platters, and smelled ivy rotting on ancient walls. Alas, my prince had transformed into a frog right before my eyes.
I'm J.W. Sutton. This story is called 47625 Town Dump Road. Okay, Pops, I think that's the last of them. Yeah, Jimmy, but good, thanks. Harold watched his son toss two full garbage bags into the overflowing pickup bed. That going to fall out on the highway? No, I've got a tarp to tie over it. Jimmy pulled blue plastic from the back seat of the crew cab. They fine you if you let that crap fly out of the truck and don't pick it up. I know, Pops. Can you help me with this? He began to tie a battered yellow rope at one end of the truck bed. Harold limped off the porch. Where's Christy? Children are for helping. She worked hard for 2 hours. I told her she could take a break. Doing what? Reading a book she found at a garage sale. Jimmy pulled the tarp into place, cinched it, and tossed the line to his father. Reading is good. Harold looped the rope through the tie down. He looked toward the garage. What about all those jugs and cans? That's junk too. Can't take those, Dad. It's hazardous waste. They'll have a collection notice in the paper, but it'll cost you. It's trash. What's the difference? The old solvents, the dirty oil, it would leak out of the landfill and poison the water. Don't they clean the water? I have a garbage pile in back since before I was born. My water is fine. Jimmy sighed. I can't do it, Pops. I don't have the room anyway. Harold frowned, shrugged, and spread his arms. Thank you so much, son. I couldn't do it on my own. Jimmy leaned into the hug, cradling his father's bent back. You're welcome, Pops. I'm glad I could help. Jimmy stepped back. I'll go stack what's left in the garage, okay? Can you please tell Christy that it's time to leave? I think she's out back. Yeah, son. He limped around the house. Christy was curled in a lawn chair, enjoying the fleeting warmth of the autumn sun. Her clothes and skin wore similar patches of grime. What are you reading? He asked.
Hi, Papa. It's called Tales of the Green Man. It's a bunch of short stories.
Green Man? Is that some hippie thing? Christy chuckled.
No, nothing like that.
She turned the cover for him to see, an old man with leaves for hair and moss for a beard.
The Green Man is like a forest spirit or fairy. He defends nature in the wild places of the world.
Like a ghost?
She shrugged. Sometimes a stranger rewarding kindness. Sometimes a monster seeking revenge.
Harold raised his eyebrows. Anyway, your father said it's time to go.
Thanks, Papa.
Thank you. You worked hard today. I see it on your face. He wiped a smudge off her cheek.
No problem.
She matched his pace until they rounded the corner. Hop in, kiddo. She gave her grandfather a last quick squeeze. He patted her back. Take care. Call me if you need anything, Pops. I will. Jimmy engulfed Harold in a gentle hug, mindful of the older man's back. Remember to keep an eye out for that hazardous waste pickup. Yeah, I'll look, he agreed. Jimmy hopped in the truck. Christy waved. Harold hobbled back inside. It was nearly sunset when the old man returned to the garage. I'm not going to pay some person to take this. That's what I pay taxes for. He opened one of the jugs Jimmy had carefully shelled. Oh, smells awful. Harold surveyed the accumulated waste, decades worth of lubricants and antifreeze and satin finish in the emerald green his wife had loved. I think it is time to take a trip to the garbage pile. He loaded a few jugs into a small wheelbarrow and trudged across the lawn into the trees beyond. 100 yards into the army of wooden sentinels, Harold came upon a rusted Ford. Dragged here by his father, it had decayed so long that a pair of aspens had sprouted and twisted together through the vacant windshield. Scattered and piled around it were bald tires, a bent boat trailer, and less easily identifiable bottles and cans and shards. Harold grabbed the first plastic jug and tossed it into the open passenger window of the old auto. As it crashed inside, a blur rushed across the forest floor and bolted up the nearest tree. Harold clutched at his chest as he jumped back. A raccoon berated him from his safe perch. Bastard! I see you again. I get you with my shotgun. The raccoon merely blinked. Ha! Laughed Harold. The best thing about living out here is no one hears how noisy I am. Pew! Harold pitched the rest of the rancid chemicals into his corroded private dump. He spit toward the raccoon and wheeled his way back to the garage. The full moon lit his path.
When he returned with another load of refuse, the shadows were deeper and the raccoon was gone. Harold made many trips, gimping and grunting his way to a clean garage. Brittle plastic cracked, and rusting lids popped loose, unseen within the dark husk of mechanical history. Sore and tired, Harold finally stowed the wheelbarrow and walked back inside. He checked to confirm that a shotgun was loaded, ate baked beans for a late dinner, turned on the TV, and fell asleep in his easy chair under an old Afghan. Harold snapped awake later. Something moved outside. He muted the TV and crept toward the door. Harold grabbed the shotgun for the raccoon. He didn't want his garbage strewn across the yard again. He opened the back door to survey his moonlit yard. No small denizens of the forest could be seen. Instead, a massive creature was tearing its way out of the tree line. Shadowed hard angles and odd protrusions in the silvery glow, it turned its vacant eye sockets toward the open door. Harold screamed and fired. A patch of turf erupted in buckshot. The flash illuminated a rusty monstrosity, all steel bones, wire sinews, and plastic veins. Harold screamed again and slammed the door as the behemoth accelerated toward the house. Harold shrank away, staring at the back door. He tripped over the end table. A broad section of the roof tore away. He screamed again as the monster leaned into the house and reached for him. The azure glow of the television lit viscous fluid pulsing through the twisted appendage. Harold fired his last shell. Dark liquid splattered across the room, but the arm never flinched as it enveloped him in its grasp. 4 days later, Jimmy called the sheriff to make a welfare check. They found Harold's body, overflowed with a stinking chemical miasma, decaying in his sodden easy chair. The TV was still on. A search of the property found no evidence of foul play. In the woods in back, a deputy was startled by a raccoon leaping from a rusted old Ford. A twining pair of aspens were growing just beside it. Thank you.
You're listening to Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince, a public reading of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry by Shawamigan Bay and Twin Ports writers. We'll take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Duluth Superior are home to many talented writers. Tonight, we feature original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 6th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organize a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 22 writers were chosen by 3 judges to read their stories and poems on the theme of transformation. The public reading was held on Saturday, January 30th, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince.
Good evening. My name is Susan Paraladui. I'm from Duluth. I have 3 really short poems. First one's called Moonshine. Goldenrod bends toward light. Dragonflies float on sunshine. In stillness of late summer, I hold you and this day. Drink this winter elixir. September blues. He leaves for his 3rd year of college. Beard, hairy legs, his blue Subaru bulging. At the trail's edge, a mole lies in wait. All around me, maple seeds twirl blush pink. At my feet, a single forget-me-not blooms late. Under a blood moon, toadstools dot the forest. Maple leaves bleed. Dragonflies dance at midday. You stand at this open door, holding my silent invitation. Thank you.
I'm Colleen Lee from Washburn. I just want to preface this piece by saying that most people are surprised when they find out that this piece was written by a woman. And see, I already made my transformation. But I just want to assure you that nobody was more surprised at this male character that came and commandeered my story than I was. My big amp, it was my 15-amp circular saw with the new carbide tip blade that took my finger. Could have been revenge. An eye for an eye, a finger for all the teeth I'd carelessly broken off of it through the years. I didn't think about it at the time. Just picked up my finger, puked, fainted, came to and dialed the sheriff. Maybe it's holding your finger in a glass of salt water on your lap, or maybe it's seeing the land that you've lived on so slowly and deliberately most of your life pass by you at 90 miles an hour. But after 5 minutes of red lights flashing, the sheriff's car lifts off the road, just a little, enough to lose all traction. It's being pulled out from under us like in a video game. I pass out, and when I come to, we're on the Cap Rock Escarpment. Another 30 minutes, and we're in Hereford, Texas. The doc in the ER, looking tired and acting giddy, cleans my wound, tells me, go home, just keep your hand up, and just be sure and ice it. I look at my severed finger in the glass of water, unmoored and homeless. But doc, what about my finger? The doc puts his hand over his mouth and fakes a cough, like he's covering up a laugh or a fart. What's so funny, I wonder, half expecting him to tell me that he doesn't give people the finger. Too mangled, he says. Getting my finger amputated isn't a big surprise. I've been dreading something like this for some time now. Yet at the same time, I've been wondering, curious, what it would be like to lose a part of myself. I'd even started dreaming weird shit about my dog. Buddy's a blue heeler, part dingo and very intuitive. In my dreams, I'd noticed that one of his legs was missing, a different one each time. Well, eventually I'd find it propped against the toilet or hanging alongside the shovels. But Buddy's eyes are wary now. I think he knows about the dream. He keeps to himself. He won't get in my bed anymore. He sleeps on his belly with his legs tucked under. It's not like I've never seen people with amputations before. And I'd seen a man with both ears burned off. If you ask me what's the saddest thing I ever saw, I'd have to say it was a young mother on a bus in Juarez with a toddler on her lap. She was playing and laughing with him. The child's arms ended where his elbows should have been, with four little cords of flesh dangling from each arm. My God, the way that mother loved on him, as if her love could grow his arms back. I admired them all. Of course, I didn't know them. Surely losing a big part of themselves like that, they must have felt the very depths of life, must have experienced great wisdom. Looking at my finger, I comfort myself with the thought that now I'll get to feel a little of what they feel, maybe learn a little of what they know. It's been 3 days now, and I'm still in shock. At least I tell myself that must be why I haven't learned a damn thing yet. I check my finger again. It's still in the salt water on the bottom of the glass next to the bed. Maybe I'm hoping someone will come and love on me and it will jump up and reattach itself. I try to remember what it feels like to be loved. It's getting dark. I move the glass under the bed where I won't trip over it. I spend the night awake in my cushioned platform rocker. The next morning, the sun arrives. Glory, hallelujah, gorgeous, fanning crimson over the morning sky. I'm reminded of the beauty of the Cap Rock, of the canyonlands, of the escarpment. I hold up my glass and toast the sun, forgetting that my finger's in it. The water's clouding up and starting to stink. I thought the worst thing that could happen about getting old would be losing your muscle. But the worst thing is reflecting back on all the times you were such an asshole. You think you know so much, but you don't know a damn thing. That's why I'm here on the escarpment, on the edge of beauty, waiting for things to shift, waiting for the knowledge to come. On the porch, I burrow down in my cushy rocker and watch the sky. Just me, Buddy, and my finger. I guess you could say we're holding awake. The finger gets to smelling really bad. I throw out the water and pull the poor thing out from the glass and carefully lay it in a matchbox. I can't believe it's no longer part of me, but at the same time, I can't believe it ever was. I keep waiting for it to rise up from the dead. When it doesn't, I dig a shallow grave and bury the finger next to my old dog, Tilly, under the basswood tree. I climb back in my rocker and curl up in the womb, in its womb. I think of my mother, of her womb, of me in it, and how I got there. Buddy comes in to check on me, like he always does when he hears me sobbing. I pet him and sob some more, and then I wait. Wait and watch for the wisdom to come. 3 days later, a northeaster's riding the caprock. It's predicted to hit here in 2 hours. The wind picks up. It bowls Buddy and me over. Buddy whimpers and goes inside using three of his legs. I stay to wait for the dawn. That's when I see it, the wisdom. It's out there on the escarpment. It's gathering up itself in sunlit bits and moving closer. It funnels up 4, 8, 12 feet. Just as it starts to lift off the ground, it shifts and spirals toward me. My mind spins with it. I think about Tilly and Buddy and the land, the comfort they have given me. Life passes before me, only it isn't my life, but the animals. Tilly and Buddy, the diamondbacks, the coyotes and prairie dogs. Then the trees moonwalk across my eyes, the buckeyes, mesquites, and cottonwoods. The funnel of wisdom comes closer, deafening me. It bears down on me, revealing every sparkling particle of its wisdom, every shining atom of its knowledge. Then it goes black and touches down on Tilly's grave. I am bursting with love. I strip off my shirt and run to meet it. Invite it in. Let it ransack my heart.
Hello, my name is Maridel Call, and I'm from Duluth, and I have four poems to read. They tend to show that transformation can happen anywhere. The first one happens at a bus stop. The second one happens on the surface of Lake Superior. The third one happens on Highway 53, heading south, and the last one takes place in a rock. First day of class at the university for seniors. I tell my sister of my plans to catch the number 6 bus. I can reach the plaza at the college in 9 minutes. She says, "Be sure to bring your backpack." I find it, now 40 years old, in my upstairs closet, dig out my composition notebook, pack cheese and apple, count my quarters, exactly 3. The driver doesn't make change. I stand at the stop across the street, wait with my 5-year-old self, wearing her new red plaid dress, carrying her Minnie Mouse lunchbox, wait as she clutches her mother's hand while the bus lumbers up the street in sharp September light. The next one is called Silver Linings. This mean spring day smothers the Wisconsin shore with fog, forces an oar boat behind gray scrim, punches grizzled waves across the lakes toward the rocks, exploding them into a shower of white chrysanthemums. The next one is called Winter Ceremony. One. At true solar noon, when sun at its highest point is low, one eagle, three crows, shadows tall on the snow, gather on a shoulder of highway to pick clean the rib cage of a deer. Two. At dusk, when sky shivers gold at the end of a tunneled forest, black wings clamber to the tops of pines, white tail feathers glide through bare-fingered branches of birch. Three. At midnight, Orion wraps stars around white bisque bones left at the side of a road. As I light one candle in a house across the field. And the last poem is called Agates. Tumbled for epochs along wave-battered shores, these stones speak of lava runs, water rage, crawling ice, wind bite. Circled round in rings of light, rust orange, yellow, red, glimpsed through layers rugged with time, these stones seduce with the shine of Venus in evening skies. Thank you.
You're listening to Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince, a public reading of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry by Shawamigan Bay and Twin Ports writers. We'll take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Duluth Superior are home to many talented writers. Tonight, we feature original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 6th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organize a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 22 writers were chosen by 3 judges to read their stories and poems on the theme of transformation. The public reading was held on Saturday, January 30th, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Here now are their writings for this year's Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince.
My name is Felicia Schneider-Hahn, and this is an excerpt from my memoir called Newlyweds Afloat. The memoir is about the more than 2 years that my husband Mark and I spent living on a trawler downtown Chicago. So this excerpt is from a chapter called A Boat from Temperance. One early morning at the service dock, I was standing by the stern, looking everything over, when the home port of our houseboat caught my eye. Beneath the boat's name, Mazurka, it read, Temperance, Michigan. Hey, Mark, I called. This is a temperance boat. Temperance, a small town in the lower southeast corner of Michigan, close to Toledo and Lake Erie, was a long way from our home in Chicago. Random House Webster's College Dictionary defines temperance as 1. Moderation or self-restraint, self-control. 2. Habitual moderation in any indulgence, appetite, etc. 3. Total abstinence from alcoholic liquors. This three-part definition pretty much sums up in chronological order how I drank. I started moderately with whiskey and wine and proceeded to habitual moderation in that I made it a habit to drink often. Moderation is up for debate. My drinking came up a few times while we dated. Once, Mark called me at my apartment. "Why are all these empty bottles on my shelf?" I knew exactly why they were there. When he was away and I hung out alone on his boat, I had drunk up a lot of his liquor. I worried what he would say if he noticed a bunch of bottles missing, and I knew he wouldn't touch them on his own. So I left the empty bottles on the shelf. On the phone, I didn't confess this. I said something about him making me feel guilty for drinking, and he dropped the subject. About 4 months into our marriage, I told Mark I wanted to quit my day job and pursue my dream of writing full-time. Mark is an exceptionally kind, generous person who wanted to do whatever he could to help me achieve my dream. He said, "Of course," and by February, I became a full-time freelance writer. And without my realizing it, my daily life soon became a habit of hiding how much I drank. Afternoons were dangerous times for me. If I was home alone, the agitation of the day would build, and by 2 o'clock, I would start looking for relief. I would pour one glass of wine and tell myself that's all I'll be having. But before that first glass was even half gone, I was itching for the next one. And then there was the trick of getting drunk, but not too drunk. Just drunk enough to be buzzed, but still able to hide it from Mark. About half an hour before he came home, I would stop drinking, eat something, and brush my teeth. After he arrived home, I had to get dinner on the table and make sure we sat down to eat as quickly as possible so that I could open a bottle of wine with dinner and continue the buzz. I would suck down 2 glasses, then insist on cleaning up and shoo him from the salon so I could finish off the remaining wine in his glass and the rest of the bottle. If he had something to do before dinner, if dinner was delayed even half an hour, I was certain he was doing it on purpose because he knew I wanted to drink and he was trying to stop me. My days started to revolve around when it was time to drink and the need to hide it from everyone around me. I yearned for places I could drink openly. And it was this impulse that, when we brought my parents on board for a Father's Day fishing excursion, led me to an all-out 3-day drinking binge. On the third morning, when everyone else was up at 5 to fish, I was up to drink. I was blitzed by 10 a.m., passed out with the spins by 1. I woke in the late afternoon as we pulled into port, half drunk, half hungover. My parents sensed trouble brewing and took a trip out in the Zodiac raft. We were alone in the salon, and Mark told me, "I just don't like all the drinking." And then he said the kicker, "It makes me wonder about having kids." "What?" I said, "that their mother will be a drunk?" "No," he said, "what they'll inherit." This stopped me. This I could not argue. We both have alcoholism in our bloodlines. I knew I was an alcoholic. I had known for a long time, but I didn't want to believe that being alcoholic meant I could no longer drink. Why not be a functional alcoholic? Except I was no longer functioning. I knew I couldn't control it, and I wouldn't be able to control whether our children got it either. The most I would be able to do would be to model for them what it was like to live as a sober alcoholic. The next day, Father's Day, as we cruised along Lake Michigan, in a plague of swarming black flies, I did not drink. The following day, back in Chicago, I went up to the flybridge alone and made a phone call to ask for help. It was the first stride on a long road of recovery. As days passed and the fog of alcohol began to clear, I slowly started walking through a day completely sober. I began to see how everything I did all day long had been attached to drinking. And now, without the crutch of alcohol, emotions came down on me full force, and I physically ached with the new experience of being checked in all the time. For the first time as an adult, I was learning to be a full participant in life. Mark supported anything I said I needed to do to learn this new way of life. He wasn't surprised to hear me say I was an alcoholic, and he did not try to control my recovery. The one night he confessed, "I knew there was something wrong in our marriage," he said. "I just thought the problem was me." That summer, I was too embarrassed to tell people I had stopped drinking and they shouldn't bring wine on board our boat. So I said nothing, and guests kept bringing wine. One night, about a month into sobriety, after we returned to A Dock and our guests had gone, I looked at the shelf and saw 8 bottles of red wine staring back at me. 8 bottles. I had never had 8 bottles of wine in my house, ever. I had fantasized about having a full wine cellar, but if there was one bottle, I drank it. I turned to my husband. "Can you give some of this away?" So, Mark started up and down A Dock, not finding it too difficult to give away Malbec and Cabernet and Shiraz to our neighbors aboard the Absolute and Cranberry. Rolling Rock 2 in green font, just like the label. Bumpy Night, flanked by 2 little martini glasses. And my favorite, Aquaholics. Somewhere in Chicago cruised the Betty Ford and Ship-Faced. That was cool. But me, I started living on a boat from Temperance. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Mary Bry Ringberg. I'm from Bayfield. And tonight is my 3rd time at Writer's Read. So here we go again. This is the tale of the transformation of one really dead banana into one really cherished memory. The banana lives. My story begins in the fall of 2011. Gordy and I were preparing for a road trip downstate for Thanksgiving. As we were packing up and heading out the door, I grabbed one lone, ready-for-eating banana off the counter. I hopped into our big blue sexy van and tossed the banana on the dashboard, where it remained for the next 8 months. Yes, during the course of that road trip, the banana did not get eaten, thrown out, or even earmarked for bread. Instead, banana became a novel traveling companion, a trusted confidant, and a fun conversation starter for anyone catching a ride in Big Blue Sexy Van. At Christmas, we decorated Banana with a festive scarf. It was made of gold tinsel. He became the banana about town. We had only one rule when it came to our fruity friend: do not touch the banana. We feared that if Banana's membrane was ever punctured, noxious banana gas could be released, and possibly toxic banana waste would seep out and ooze its way down the dash and eventually infect us all with, wait for it, bananitis. So a warning was issued to all who entered Big Blue Sexy Van, including parking valets and the service technicians at the Toyota dealership. Fortunately, no one ever really wanted to touch Banana. Over the next few months, Banana experienced a great deal of melt and freeze, melt and freeze, melt and freeze action. One very hot day in July, Justine and I had to run errands in Ashland. We hopped into Big Blue Sexy Van, and it was immediately clear to both of us that it was time to say goodbye. Banana had to go. The only thing that could possibly smell worse than our van did that day is the stench from 26,000 Iowan hogs. With Justine behind the wheel, we started our journey down Highway 13. We took turns eulogizing Banana. Banana, having grown up in the Banana Republic, was the best of the bunch. Excuse me. We have traveled down the same road a lot of miles together. He always seemed comfortable in his own peel. Banana was rich in potassium. He was the ultimate knock-knock joke. He was quiet, kept to himself, yet was still appealing. He was truly the top banana. Next, we sang a few of Banana's favorite tunes. I'm a Chiquita banana, and I've come to say, I have a big banana every day. Hey, every day, hey, every day. Cha, cha, cha. Yes, we have ripe bananas, very ripe bananas today. Our closing number was Beethoven's classic banana hit. Banana. Everybody, banana. I used an ice scraper to pry Banana from the dash. Pry him from the dash he had become rather attached to. Then we had to wait for the appropriate time to chuck Banana. We needed to make sure there were no cars approaching or following, since we didn't want to be seen as litter bugs. When the perfect moment arrived, I lowered the window, gently lifted Banana, still sporting his holiday scarf, and flung him out into the wilds of Highway 13. Justine and I became very quiet. We became solemn. And then we became hysterical and laughed so hard, like pee your pants hard. A couple hours later, heading home to Bayfield at the exact spot a chipmunk scurried across the highway with something long and brown in its chippy mouth. We knew it was Banana from the glint off his tinsel scarf. The banana lives, we cheered. The banana lives. Understandably, this became one of our favorite stories. Somewhere along Highway 13, the banana lives. Fast forward to spring of 2014. A lot had changed in our family. My daughter Kayleen and I went traveling down Highway 51. We decided to stop at the spot where the accident occurred. Now that all the snow had melted, we were hoping to find Justine's wallet, which had not been recovered. We climbed down the embankment and did not find the wallet, or much of anything, really. After a few minutes, Kayleen helped me back up to the shoulder of the road. I looked down, and at my feet was a shriveled up old banana peel. Convinced it was a sign from Justine and was our banana, I proclaimed, "The banana lives." Kayleen, thinking I had truly gone bananas, asked if I was seriously going to keep that gross withered peel. I told her, "Hell yeah, the banana lives." Was it a coincidence? I think not. A sign from above? Absolutely. Well, I did bring the banana peel home. Today, it sits prominently next to the jar of Justine's ashes on top of our liquor cabinet. Every day I look over at Banana and can't help but smile. It's a comforting reminder that the banana lives on, as does the fun-loving spirit of my Justine. My good friend, Dr. Seuss, once told me, "Sometimes you will never know the value of a moment until it becomes a memory." Thank you.
That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. Join us again next week for more stories and poetry from Shawamigan Bay and Twin Ports writers. You've been listening to Writers Read, From a Frog to Prince. The event is produced by Northland College in partnership with Wisconsin Public Radio and Aqueous Magazine. Our thanks to the event's organizer, Julie Buckles, and Northland College, as well as the three judges, Cynthia Belmont, Claire Duquette, and Gina Kirsten. We also thank the writers, Jan Chronister, Carol Dunbar, Liz Minette, Diana Granger, J.W. Sutton, Suzanne Perala-Dewey, Colleen Lee, Maridel Call, and Felicia Schneiderhan. I'm Danielle Kading. Have a great rest of your week, and we hope you're back with us next Monday evening.